Morning, all. We open today's events with a discussion of the case of Johnson v. Wysocki. We have a civil transfer case. Transfer has been granted. As you know, each side has been allotted 20 minutes. The appellants, lawyers for the Johnsons, will argue first. And the Johnsons' lawyers are Catherine Brown Henry and Garrett Lawton. Thank you. And for the Wysockis, or for the Wysocki Living Trust, we have Sean Olson, assisted by Christopher Schmidtgill. Thank you very much. We're ready to go. If you could begin, Ms. Brown Henry, we'll hear what you have to say.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, counsel. Practically every seller of a home in Indiana must fill out a disclosure form. And this disclosure form states on its face that the information contained in it is true to the best of the seller's current actual knowledge, with this phrase current actual knowledge being placed in all capitalized letters and repeated within the form in three different locations. In this case, the trial court erred when it found the Johnsons liable for statements in a disclosure form based upon a constructive knowledge standard. Specifically, the trial court found that the issues in the property should have been obvious to the Johnsons at the time they sold the property. This phrase, should have been obvious, is a finding of constructive knowledge. But that's not the standard in Indiana, because Indiana Code 3221.511 states that a seller is not liable for any error, inaccuracy, or omission in the disclosure form that the seller does not have actual knowledge of. Rather, this statute tells us that our legislature intended for liability for these statements in a disclosure form to occur in very limited circumstances, and that's when a buyer proves a seller's actual knowledge.
How would you prove that? I mean, you can see how you could prove constructive knowledge, but as a practical matter, how would you ever prove actual knowledge?
Well, these are going to be fact-sensitive cases, and it's going to hang on a multitude of information. In cases like Vanderveer, they establish actual knowledge through the use of expert testimony. In Wise v. Hayes, summary judgment was not granted because there was actual letters from the Army Corps of Engineers to the property owner stating that the property didn't meet the means for which it was to be intended to be used. So. In our case, the trial court took in expert testimony and all the evidence and decided that the evidence was sufficient to infer constructive knowledge, but it did not go as far as to state that it established actual knowledge.
Did the trial court conclude that they should have known or that they must have known?
The phrase that the trial court used was the phrase should have been obvious, which is the same as saying should have known. So in our case, it's our contention that this is only a finding of constructive knowledge. It does not rise to the level of actual knowledge that is required.
What happens when you take that statement you just made and the comment made by the trial court judge and just look at this disclosure form in a truly literal sense, and it says, is correct to the best of the seller's current actual knowledge? And then there are numerous places where it says not defective. I read, to the best of the seller's current actual knowledge, and the option not defective, as it's my actual knowledge and it's not defective. Because as a seller, I can check do not know, do not know, do not know, do not know. So when I look at the disclosures form and read it literally and then look at what the judge said, it seems to me your position is more difficult.
Well, and
what am I missing?
The fact that you're correct that it states is not defective, that was the information that the trial court took in. And since in our case we have the trial court making special findings of fact under Trial Rule 52A, his special finding of fact was, despite these statements, the evidence to him was only sufficient enough to go to the level of a should have been obvious level. He didn't say the issues were obvious to the Johnsons. He did not say that the issues were known to the Johnsons.
But he did have findings concerning credibility determination, correct?
Yes, he stated that he had reviewed the evidence and weighed the credibility of the witnesses. And after that, he made these specific findings of fact. And it's our position that since judgment may not be affirmed on any ground not found in the findings, even though found in the record, that this court is limited to the finding, what to determine whether the findings of fact actually support the judgment.
Did either party move for move the judge to find for findings of fact under Rule 52?
Yes, the Johnsons made that motion, and it was granted by the trial court. So, as to another point, what I think this statute is reflecting is our legislature's intent not to create what would be warranties on the property, statutory warranties, and it did not create or it did not abrogate a buyer's duty to inspect the property. What this does is just create a very limited duty on a seller to disclose that which they have actual knowledge of. It's not meant to go beyond that scope of what a seller has actual knowledge of. And whether a buyer can actually bring a claim for fraudulent misrepresentation, which was actually pled and litigated in this case, has actually created a split in our Court of Appeals. And on one side of the split, we have a set of opinions that states that caveat emptor would defeat a buyer's fraud claim, holding that a seller has no right to rely on the statements in a disclosure form when they have a reasonable opportunity for an inspection. But on the other side of this, we have a set of opinions stating that a caveat emptor will not preclude a buyer's fraud claim. And in those cases, the courts have held that a seller may be held liable for fraudulent misrepresentation when a buyer proves the seller's actual knowledge of the defects in the property. So in this case, whether caveat emptor applies or not, the Wysockis are not entitled to a recovery, because either caveat emptor applies and the Wysockis have no right to rely upon the statements within the Johnson's disclosure, or under this other set of rules, the trial court has not gone to the point that it's found actual knowledge in this case, which would also preclude the Wysockis.
So, are you arguing a sufficiency of the evidence? Is that essentially your argument? Whether it's on the caveat emptor under the common law, whether it's actual knowledge under the statute. Is your argument again that this is basically the evidence was not sufficient?
Our argument is that the findings of fact aren't sufficient to support the judgment.
Let's assume, for example, that if there is, and your argument is that even if there is evidence in the record to support actual knowledge, that evidence did not show up in the trial court's findings.
That's correct, Your Honor. So in our case, what the trial court found was, again, this actual knowledge. It was not actual knowledge. It was constructive knowledge. And so in that respect, it's our position that whether it's the common law or the common law application of caveat emptor to these claims of fraudulent misrepresentation, or if it's this Court of Appeals holding that a seller may be liable. In this instance, the Wysockis have not carried their burden of proof that the Johnsons had actual knowledge of these issues.
The Court of Appeals seemed to have reweighed the evidence. They went through a lot of checking with the evidence to agree with your position. If this court takes the view that the trial court's findings, although not as extensive as they otherwise might have been, if there's enough in these findings to support the view that there's actual knowledge, would the record support that?
I don't think that the record would support that position, because the evidence that the Wysockis presented was mostly the fact that these issues existed and not that the Johnsons had knowledge of them. In fact, the Johnsons denied knowledge of any of these things, and it was the Wysockis.
So that gets to be a credibility problem, doesn't it? If the evidence points in favor of perhaps Johnsons did in fact know, and the Johnsons get on the stand and say, "Oh no, I didn't know anything about it." But here's your disclosure. Well, I don't remember signing it, or and I'm not liable because I did it as a trustee of a trust. I mean, that's a credibility calculus, isn't it?
And I think the trial court took that credibility into account when it made its findings of fact, that it didn't rise to the level that the trial court could state that the Johnsons knew of the problems in the property. That would be all part of the evidence that the trial court took in this case. And still, what it seems that the Wysockis are arguing is an interpretation that would lead to a level of actual knowledge, which is not what the trial court found.
The trial court did, in the paragraph before, the one that you're talking about here should have been obvious. I mean, they cite the correct law. They cite the correct standard with regard to talking about the Van der Weyer case. And nonetheless, sellers can be held liable for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions based on actual knowledge. The trial court had 3 days. Was it 3 days of testimony?
Yes.
Sifted through a lot of evidence with regard to each particular claim and did not find for the plaintiffs on several of their claims, correct?
That's correct.
And ended up with approximately $13,000 worth of damage. When you read the order with regard, they set the correct standard, they weighed through the evidence, a lot of evidence came in. You're resting your case on lack of knowledge based on the should have been obvious and not on the fact that he talked about extensively considering Indiana statutory law, common law, credibility of witnesses, and the judge weighed out each of these claims with the testimony.
Well, in this case, this is actually the second fraudulent misrepresentation case for Judge Svetnov that's gone up on appeal. The Van der Veer is also an appeal from a decision of Judge Svetnov. And in that case, Judge Svetnov clearly stated in his findings of fact that the sellers knew of the defect. And he didn't go that far in this case. And I think what we need to point out is what our legislature intended to happen here. It was not to hold a seller liable for statements based upon a constructive knowledge standard. And if the trial court wanted to find actual knowledge, he could have simply done that by saying the Johnsons knew of the problems.
Are you asking for a reversal and a remand on the issue of whether there was actual knowledge?
We're asking for a reversal and for judgment to be entered in favor of the Johnsons, because the trial court has already established his finding of fact as to the knowledge of the Johnsons. There's nothing to reconsider on that point. He's already weighed the evidence and come to the conclusion of a constructive knowledge standard.
But you, in looking at the common law remedies and then looking at the statutory, would you agree then that the remedies to a buyer are broader under a statutory claim?
The Wysockis in their petition to transfer stated that they are entitled to a separate statutory claim. That is not what our legislature intended to create with this statute. The legislature did not state that this statute shall hold a homeowner liable. It says a homeowner is not liable. It's creating a defense, a safe harbor from liability. And what it's doing is creating a situation where when a buyer brings a claim for fraudulent misrepresentation, that they're not precluded from that claim. If caveat emptor applied, they would have no claim because they'd have no right to rely upon that statement. And our legislature has decided that in a limited circumstance, when it rises out of these disclosures, that they're going to permit liability and only when the buyer can prove a seller's actual knowledge on that claim.
Is it your view that the statutory notice and requirements, etc., abrogates the common law of caveat emptor, or is it a separate remedy altogether? What's your view on that?
It's not our position that it's a separate remedy. For one thing, in this case, fraudulent misrepresentation what was pled and litigated. And another reason it's not a separate statutory claim is that...
I guess my question is, has the statute, in your view, abrogated the common law or no?
Yes, it has abrogated the common law position that caveat emptor would apply to these cases to preclude a claim and would only permit a claim by a buyer based on fraudulent misrepresentation when they can prove a seller's actual knowledge. So, and I think one of the things that we need to talk about with regards to the legislative intent is the fact that the legislature only put a duty to disclose that which they have actual knowledge of. It didn't place a duty on a seller to inspect the property. And at the common law, our courts have recognized that a seller has a duty to investigate. And I think one of the reasons why the legislature developed these disclosure statutes was to give buyers more information about the property so that they will be able to investigate the property. And in that respect, this is an information portion to the buyer so that they can go about doing their duty to inspect. And we see this because Indiana Code 322159 states that these disclosures are not warranties and are not a substitute for any warranties or inspections that a prospective buyer may later obtain on the property.
What would be your argument We have said that the legislature doesn't intend to abrogate the common law unless it does so in express terms or implication. What is it about the statute, the disclosure statute, would you say shows that the legislature intended to abrogate the common law of caveat emptor?
I think that in the language is by implication, in the fact that it states that a seller is not liable and for any error, inaccuracy, or omission. And in that doing that, the court recognizes that there are cases in which a seller could be liable.
So that would be some tension between that and the rule of buyer beware.
That's correct.
And so by enacting this statute, they intended to abrogate that portion of the.
I believe that they did. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. And so, briefly, we would ask that this court reverse judgment in favor of the Johnsons and have judgment entered in their favor. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown Henry.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, good morning and thank you for hearing us today. Indiana adopted the sales disclosure form requirement for sellers in 1993. That followed a trend that started in California in 1991, which by 2004, about two-thirds of the states had adopted some form or manner of a sales disclosure form requirement for sellers of residential real estate. At this time, pretty much all states have some form of compulsory disclosure requirement for sellers, and the statute that Indiana has is somewhat typical of all the other statutes across the country, in that the seller has to provide some information as to the parts of the house that would most affect its viability or the health, life, and safety of the building and its occupants, the roof, structure, things of that nature. From that, the statutes have also said that, and the courts interpreting those cases, including in Indiana, have looked at it in terms of a seller can be held liable for misrepresentations of fact on those disclosure forms in the event that they have actual knowledge of a problem or defect with whatever it is that we're talking about. Now, the question in Indiana, and I've had the pleasure of trying a few cases involving transactions of real estate, residential real estate, where there's been issues of whether or not the seller has accurately disclosed conditions or issues with the property on the sales disclosure form. And the trouble with trying these cases, especially over the last 10 years or 9 years, is that the cases in the Court of Appeals, the 8 different cases that we've had so far, they've come out somewhat in bunches. We had the one in 2002, one in 2004, a two in 2004, and then the set in 2006, and then we had the trio in 2009 and 2010. And they all seem to shift the sands, and nobody's really been upfront or clear as to what the real effect of the statute is in relation to the common law theory of fraud and what a buyer can or cannot do in presenting a claim for recovery of for problems that they discover with the house after they purchase it.
Would you agree that the that the statutes give a much broader leeway and remedy to a buyer than does the common law?
I would very much agree that it gives much more leeway. And the reason.
So in your brief, you talk about having maybe two approaches. How does that help you? I mean, if it's buyer beware under the common law, you certainly don't want that.
Right.
So why would you even advance an argument that says I can pursue a common law remedy as well as a statutory?
It depends on the facts of the case, and I would suggest that there are certain circumstances where a person may claim and a court might find that a seller doesn't have actual knowledge. And the reason for that is they somewhat stuck their heads in the sand and chose not to acknowledge that there's problems with the property.
Well, here in this particular situation, correct me if I'm wrong, other than the sales disclosure form, your clients in this particular case would not even have any common law fraud claim as a practical matter because there were no discussions between your clients directly and the defendants concerning the status of the property, condition of the property. Is that a fair statement?
That other than the disclosure is correct.
So you could have a situation where there's a disclosure form and it says, with respect to plumbing, maybe do not know. And during the course of conversations between the prospective buyer and seller, the seller says, well, as a practical matter, absolutely no problems, absolutely no problems. And that is proven to be untrue, and you still would have a common law fraud type claim, in your opinion?
I think both claims are still viable.
Well, you could have a seller that says, the buyer says, well, I'm going to get an inspection, and the seller could say, you don't need an inspection. I'm telling you, it's in pristine condition. I mean, you can create a factual scenario. But here, you win or lose based on your ability to utilize the disclosure form as a basis for your cause of action.
Right. In this case, that was the sole communication between the parties. In this case, the Wysockis were moving from Arizona. They signed an offer shortly after Ms. Wysocki had an opportunity to walk through the house. They signed an offer on July 12th of 2006. The Johnsons accepted that offer the following day, on the 13th. On the 14th, they had the inspection of the property. And then on the 28th, they purchased the property. They actually closed. And the Wysockis weren't even actually at the closing. Because of the nature of their move, it was fairly expedited. They had to get here and get here quick. So, yeah, the only thing that happened here, the only communication effectively, is the sales disclosure form.
So would you, I mean, when you say you have, you think you have a viable both common law and statutory claim, but the common law, CAGNY and the progeny pretty consistently talk about the opportunity to inspect, and you not only had an opportunity to inspect, you didn't inspect. So how would you have a viable common law under the common law claim?
In this particular case, that is the drawback with the common law claim. You have to get around CAGNY. You have to show that despite the opportunity to inspect, that inspection wouldn't reasonably have provided the means to discover the problem. There's a case, Grissom versus Moran from 1972, which says that a purchaser may rely on statements of fact from the seller when those facts are particularly within the knowledge of the seller and not otherwise readily noticeable. In this particular case, with the problems or defects that the trial court found that there were problems with, we have the electrical service underneath the screened-in patio out back in the behind the house. Well, the original electrical that was run through there was done by a contractor in 1975. Every single change to that electrical service since then was done by Mr. Johnson. Apologies. And when he did this, he didn't have an electrician come out. He's not an electrician by trade. And the unfortunate thing is that all the work that he did is underneath literally this deck, which by the time the Wysockis got there, had a level of cedar planking skirting underneath it, which was overlapped by another layer of the skirting, which at the top had aluminum wrapping, which took Mr. Wysocki about 40 minutes to finally get through before he could actually get to it. In a common real estate transaction where you have an inspector come out the property, almost every single inspection report I've ever seen, an inspection contract that I've seen, they all say, we're not going to take apart things. We're not going into areas that we can't access. We can't obviously tell you what's going on there.
Well, Tone, I keep having, in this case, is that the trial court, the question here, there was no doubt, I gather, that the Johnsons knew that something was wrong with this property. But the problem is whether they had actual knowledge and whether the trial court, well, take that back, I don't know if they knew, but the trial court never said that they had actual knowledge. And isn't that critical here? I mean, trial court made no such finding.
That is the crux of the argument, and or at least one of the issues in this case. And I take the position of Justice Rush that the court immediately in the paragraph before this finding that they should have had knowledge specifically says and quotes the correct standard of review for the statutory analysis of actual knowledge. I don't know. And I indicated in my brief, maybe the wording was a little imprecise, but we have a situation where the last major modification or renovation to the property was done in 1996. From there, we can see that things have happened. And the thought is that somebody who's lived in the house and hasn't done anything with it, allegedly for 10 years, and there's still problems, they should have known, or they did know. You can't just live in a house and typically not know that there's water sloshing around. Or
you're switching to the factual analysis. Justice Rucker is inquiring more about the legal procedural issue, where we have the specific findings of the trial court that allegedly do not support the judgment because they do not say actual knowledge.
Right.
What's your position about what the courts should, about this court should do if we find that the language the trial judge used is insufficient to comply with the statutory warranty provision?
I would suggest that because there's this, I would say, ambiguity between the two consecutive paragraphs, paragraph 10 and paragraph 11 of the court's opinion, that if the court did say that this language isn't good enough, then it should be remanded to the trial court for the trial court to determine, since he had the opportunity to weigh the credibility of the witnesses, to determine if there was actual knowledge. If the trial court does determine that there's actual knowledge and clarifies that, well, that resolves the issue.
Do you have any authority for the proposition that this should be remanded for more findings where the trial court specifically has not made? In other words, why is this not just an outright reversal? If the trial court's findings doesn't support the judgment, is there authority for the proposition that the remedy is to remand for more specific findings in this context?
I honestly researched that, and I apologize.
What was the sale price, eventual sale price, not the list price, but the sale price of the home?
I can't.
Is it 260, 270, 280, somewhere along in there?
North of 200,000.
And according to the record, the sum total of the actual damages that the trial court found were owing from the trust or trustees or sellers to the buyers was about $13,000?
Correct.
So that's less than, 5% of the value of the home the trial court found needed to put the home in the condition that it should have been in, arguably, right?
Or that was represented to be in, yeah.
And then I'm back here struggling with this form. It says defect means a condition that would have a significant adverse effect on the value of the property that would significantly impair the health or safety of future occupants of the property, or that if not repaired, removed, or replaced, would significantly shorten or adversely affect the expected normal life of the premises. I'm struggling with that too. $13,000 in damages on a $275,000 fair market value home. Any comment on that? I couldn't find anybody really raised that, and I couldn't find where the trial court judge, he seems to suggest this was a defect, but I'm not sure there's a marrying of the form.
Right, and I mean that is a part of the form, and I think the focus, for lack of a better way of putting it, the focus has just been on the actual representations made on the form. Now, if you have a structural problem, which is alleged to have occurred with a screened-in patio with the deck posts and whatnot, then clearly that's something that can cause significant problems and certainly shorten the lifespan and expected use of that deck.
Well, is it all or nothing? I mean, if the gas grill, and I put not defective, and I clearly knew the gas grill was defective, is there a cause of action against me for a new gas grill because of the sales disclosure form? I find that kind of hard to believe, because that doesn't seem to be a defect that's going to significantly affect the value of the home.
Right. I guess.
And I don't think that the legislature, you think, intend to create these little cause of actions for those types of things?
I think the legislature intended to hand the question of whether or not, or what issues or items to include in a sales disclosure form, to the real estate commission to identify what things typically relate to issues that might shorten the lifespan or expected use of a property. Now, it's a form, so it's not a, unfortunately, it's not a one-size-fits-all. But it is a form, and the seller does have to make representations about each and every item. And certainly, some of the items on there were any improvements made with the required permits or without the required permits. That might not have happened, and it might be of no moment because there's no actual problem with it. Sort of like the grass, the grill that you mentioned. If there's no actual damage or injury from it, well, then perhaps it's of no moment. But when that lack of a permit causes something to develop with the property or has caused a problem with the property, that's the problem. If the gas grill causes an explosion because there's a known problem with it that's not disclosed, well, then you have damages and then we can look at it. But I think Judge Veda put it well. Purchasers of property don't go in to buy a house with an eye towards litigation or future problems. They're just looking to purchase a house and hopefully not have any problems with it. Oddly enough, part of this movement towards the sales disclosure form requirements, and it was pushed by the National Association of Realtors. There's an interesting article I came across about it. George Lefko wrote an article which basically shows the transition of how the real estate industry has pushed this disclosure requirement to transfer or translate states' laws with regards to the residential real estate from caveat emptor to, as he puts it, seller tell all. Everybody knows that in a fraud context, if you make a disclosure about something, well, you just can't make a half statement. You have to go all out. You can't just shorten it and say, you know, we took care of it or whatnot. You have to say, if you start talking about it or you are inquired about it and you make a statement about it, you have to disclose everything you know about the problem.
Mr. Olson, as we look at the disclosure statement here, which of the representations are you predicating your case upon?
Primarily,
and that are found by the trial court.
Primarily, the issues are in the other disclosures. It's on page 2 of the disclosure form itself, and starting from the top, coming down to, are there any foundation problems with the improvements?
Okay.
Are there any violations to zoning, building codes, or restrictive covenants? Are there any structural problems with the building? Have any substantial additions or alterations been made without a required building permit? Are there moisture and or water problems in the basement, crawl space area, or any other area? I believe that's the majority.
All right. And as to these...
does the roof leak? I'm sorry.
Okay. As to each one of these, the seller checked the no column, right?
Correct.
And I would ask you, and I hope that Ms. Brown-Henry also responds during her rebuttal, of how is the court to understand the language of the disclosure statement, which it doesn't say seller is required to give a list of defects based upon current actual knowledge. It says the seller states that the information contained is correct based upon current actual knowledge. The information that seller is giving is, in all of those specific points you mentioned, is don't know, is oh, no, wait a minute. No, it is not. It is not do not know. It's no.
Correct.
It's the affirmative declaration that there is nothing wrong. And so the question is, how do we apply current actual knowledge to affirmative declarations that something is not defective, that is safe? That seemed to be a little bit different than a do not know declaration, but there's actually an affirmative representation here that something is actually safe within my actual knowledge.
If one says that they don't know, then that's just an expression that they may or may not know. They have no way of knowing. If you're actually making a statement that there is no problem based on what you actually know, then you have to have some form of knowledge or basis to support that. It's not something you can just go through, or at least I hope it's not something you can just go through the form and check no.
They don't have to have that. You have to have that. If you're going to contend that that's a breach, you have to show that they had actual knowledge to the contrary of their representation. Isn't that right?
Correct. And that's what I was somewhat getting at. When they fill out this form, they literally have to go through and make a considered declaration and decision as to each one of these. And the trial record shows that in this particular case, Mrs. Johnson, with Mr. Johnson next to her, took about 35 to 45 minutes to go through this two-page form.
That's fine, but tell me from the evidence, what are the best examples that the evidence shows in your favor that the Johnsons, based upon their actual knowledge, misrepresented that there was nothing wrong?
I see my time has expired. May I answer your question?
Please do.
Thank you, Your Honor. The highlights very quickly are with the deck, the screened-in patio. Along the north side of this patio, where the sinking is occurring, which makes the deck go down at least half inch every year, every deck post has a sister post next to it. And what I mean by that, it's another board that helps support the weight of the deck. And there's also a screw jack there as well, something you can use for a car. If you have a flat tire, you can screw it up and it jacks it up. When those posts were dug out, you found that instead of going all the way down to the frost line of 48 inches, which is required in Lake County, Indiana, it was determined that the deepest anyone went was 7 inches, and they were all decayed, and most were 2, 3, or 4 inches. Mr. Johnson is the one who put that deck in, and Mrs. Johnson saw him doing it. That's, I guess, the problem there. The electrical service, you have literally a ball of wire, exposed wire, sitting on the ground. The contractor left it in conduit and going into junction boxes. The wiring ended up sitting literally on the ground with extension cords running from here to there, which isn't an approved situation, or isn't compliant with code. The electrical service running to the pool, which when it was replaced in 2003, it's supposed to be upgraded at that point, and they didn't do that either.
Could you comment briefly, just very briefly for me, before he turns up? Would you respond briefly to the claim that if these are fraudulent misrepresentations that were made, they were made by Mrs. Johnson, but only in her capacity as trustee of the trust, and they could not be held individually liable? Just take a minute to sort of comment, would you?
Right. As far as that, I believe the trust code speaks to that, and it reflects agency code to a large degree, where typically an agent isn't responsible for the contract of the principal. However, in this particular case, as an agency, a agent is liable for their own acts or omissions in regards to the transaction. And Indiana Code Section 30-4-3-10 talks about trustee liability. If the trustee is liable for a situation rising out of the administration of the trust, the trustee can be personally liable for that, and to the extent that their assets aren't sufficient, then the trust is liable as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Ms. Brown-Henry, rebuttal.
Your Honors, there needs to be some finality to these transactions. And from what I'm hearing Mr. Olson argue is to have this court, in essence, redraft this statute so that constructive knowledge can be considered by the court, and that the duty on a buyer, or on a seller, excuse me, would be expanded to make them not just disclose what they have actual knowledge of, but also to investigate any work that they've ever had done in the house. In the Room case, we saw that the court rejected that argument, holding that the buyer doesn't have a duty to discover any problems that existed in the house of which they have no knowledge of. The sole duty that our legislature placed on the sellers of a home is to disclose that which they have actual knowledge of. The duty to inspect still lies with the buyer. And this information really is to inform the buyer about the property so that if they determine that they do need a more thorough inspection of the roof or of, say, leakage in a basement or of a sewage system, that they can go about in doing that. But the duty, the buyer still has an obligation to do their due diligence in the purchase of the property. What I don't think the legislature intended to do would be to provide a means by which these transactions would hang over a seller's head for years to come after the money has already been distributed to pay off mortgages or to purchase another property. And I think part of what Mr. Olson did was try to re-argue the evidence. In this case, the trial court's already considered the evidence. He made special findings of fact that were based upon a motion by the Johnsons to find them. And to, it's not this, the role of this court to go and scour the record for evidence which might support actual knowledge when the trial court has already taken in the statements in the disclosure form and the evidence that he's heard and has actually found not only that there's no finding of actual knowledge, the trial court does not even make a finding of reliance on this disclosure
statement. But didn't the Court of Appeals do just that? Didn't they scour the record to find contradictory evidence to the trial court findings?
Even if the Court of Appeals did do that, that error is harmless because the Court of Appeals also pointed out that the trial court only made a finding of constructive knowledge and that wasn't sufficient to support the judgment. And as to Justice Dixon, you were talking about whether these statements, how do we apply them as a current knowledge? What this is doing is giving general, broad information. If in this case, the Wysockis point to very specific issues in the home. They had the opportunity to review this disclosure statement and then go back to the Johnsons and make further inquiries.
But when the legislature required this form to be completed and the seller makes an affirmative assurance that there is nothing wrong with electrical or foundations or whatever, isn't the intention of that to tell the seller you don't have to do due diligence or further inspection of this, you have my word on it?
No, I don't believe that's what our legislature intended, because the legislature also included a statute that states that these disclosure forms are not a substitute for an inspection. And so while these disclosures can help guide a seller, I think it's important to remember at the common law, a seller didn't have an obligation to tell the buyer anything about the property. But our legislature decided in a very narrow circumstance it wanted to provide information to a buyer. And it's our position that this statute needs to be narrowly construed to show that what our legislature intended here. The legislature did not intend for constructive knowledge.
In fact, you would have it so narrowly construed that it would be meaningless, wouldn't it?
It would not be meaningless, Your Honor, because it would still permit a claim for fraudulent misrepresentation if the buyer can prove a seller's actual knowledge.
Or this is intended to help me out, the buyer, and I take this and I say, okay, now, Mr. Seller, I have a few questions. You indicated the foundation system is fine. Have you had it inspected recently? Have you been down there recently? The screen porch is fine. Have you done any construction? And then version is, I as a seller say, sure, yeah, it's all fine. Then I may now have led myself into some sort of a misrepresentation or fraud claim.
In that situation, then I think yes, but that's not this particular case. This particular case was solely statements in the disclosure form. There were no further communications between the parties. I think in your situation, Justice David, then if the seller can show...
Well, I was trying to help you out with a friendly question because, because I mean, what's it good for?
It's good.
What is this good for?
It's good to help the buyer make an offer on the house because the seller can't accept an offer until they receive the disclosure form, and it also helps them in guiding them in their investigation of the property. Thank you.
Now, I know your time has run, but I do want to make one further inquiry.
Sure.
As I'm wrestling with this language, you point out the should have been obvious language.
Yes.
One thing this is not is an affirmative finding that there was no actual knowledge, okay? That would have been stronger for your case had the trial court said that. It said it should have been obvious. Now, if we take the factual representations from your opposing counsel that there were failures to comply with the electrical code or the foundation, the depth and the patio deck, and his claim that these things were built by the seller. So obviously the seller had knowledge of how deep they were or where they were. And the trial court hears that, assuming gives it credibility, and says, it should have been obvious to the Johnsons that this was a defect. That would lead this reading of the findings to say actual knowledge, wouldn't it?
I don't believe that it would go to the level of actual knowledge, because if you look in our case law, it states that constructive knowledge is that which an actor should have known. It doesn't go to the level of what an actor does know. And the difference is that actual knowledge is direct and clear knowledge, whereas constructive knowledge is knowledge that is implied upon a party by the law. And so our legislature, in drafting this, decided that it was only going to limit the scope to actual knowledge.
Fair enough, but there's a continuum here. And as an earlier question indicated, proof of actual knowledge requires us getting in the seller's brain and saying, what does they really know? And if you have a case where the sellers receive correspondence or official inspections that give them a report and say something's wrong here, that could still lead the trial judge to say he should have known. He got a letter telling him it was so. That is not something less than actual knowledge?
Exactly, Your Honor. It would be less than actual knowledge, because while the evidence may be sufficient to infer constructive knowledge, it's up to the fact finder to determine whether it rises to the level of actual knowledge.
But Your Honor, there's a vote if he looks at all that and has almost identical findings to what we have in this record, but he says he had actual knowledge.
Then we'd
he could have come to
case.
That conclusion based on this evidence. You would concede that, wouldn't you?
If that was what he found, but that's not what our trial court found.
Mr. Chief Justice, one very quick question in honor of Justice Sullivan.
If the trial court judge, had said in his findings, I find that the sellers did not tell the truth, you lose? I find that the sellers did not tell the truth on the issue of knowledge. You lose, correct?
I think so, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We appreciate your discussion today. We will endeavor to reach a prompt conclusion and let you know when we do.
All right.